Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Canadian writer Jan Martel. He is the author of two novels and a collection of short stories. The second novel, the one that has gotten so much attention, is Life of Pi. It is now available in paperback, published by Harcourt. This book won the Man Booker Prize 2002. This is a prize that's given each year to a novel written in English. The only qualification is that the writer is from either the UK, the Commonwealth, Ireland, Pakistan, or South Africa. And the award is announced in October. In fact, just the winner for this year was just recently announced. He's an Australian writer. And a little bit more about our guest. He was born actually in Spain. His parents were teachers and also diplomats. He grew up in a number of places. He lived in Alaska, in Mexico, in Costa Rica, in France, and in Canada. And he has traveled a lot. He's been in Iran and Turkey, in Europe, Ecuador, other places. He's a graduate of Trent University in Ontario. When he first went to college, he was studying anthropology. Then he switched to philosophy and has a degree in philosophy from Trent. Then he got interested in writing and has been doing that since. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and will give a talk in the MillerCom series. That will be tonight at 7:30 in the auditorium of Smith Memorial Hall. That's on South Matthews in Urbana. There are a number of sponsors for this particular event, but we'd like to single out the Department of English and the MFA program in creative writing. And of course, the Miller Committee. These events are always free and open to anybody who would like to attend. So if you're interested, you can do that. Also, by the way, the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities will be presenting a panel discussion, Jan Martel, Life of Pi and the World of Religion, tomorrow at 4 in the afternoon. This is at 805 West Pennsylvania in Urbana. And I think there also, anybody who's would like to attend is welcome to do that. And of course, here on the program, if you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, the number 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. For people who have not read Life of Pi, I guess I would say just the barest thumbnail sketch is, it is the story of an Indian boy named Pi Patel. The first part of the book is about his youth and his growing up. His father runs a zoo, so he grows up around the zoo and around the animals. Mm-hmm. And then at one point, the father decides to relocate the family, and the plan is to go to Canada. And they make arrangements to find homes for all of these animals, and they load a lot of them onto a freighter. The family gets on board, and they head off. And there's a shipwreck. He survives, finds himself on a lifeboat, with a tiger, a full-grown Bengal tiger, and then proceeds to spend the next 200 and some days drifting, trying to survive, keep himself alive, and also keep the tiger alive. The book has gotten, as I say, lots of positive attention. Many, many people have enjoyed it, and it won the prize. And I enjoyed writing it myself.
Good.
It was very good. I guess a number of questions. The first section of the book, as we read about Pi and his experiences as a young man, has a lot to do with matters of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Pi, his parents, while they're not particularly religious, he's nominally a Hindu. He, in the course of that part of his childhood, one day walks into a Catholic church and starts talking with the priest there and kind of bonds with him, and then pretty soon decides he'd like to become a Christian, mm-hmm. which he does. Then a little bit later, he sort of has the same experience. He wanders into the mosque, starts talking with the imam, and thinks, well, there's some good things here. So he says, I think I'd like to become a Muslim.
Mm.
So here we have a young man who believes that there's no reason why he shouldn't be all three. He could be a Christian, Hindu, and a Muslim. Obviously, he says something like, well, all I'm interested in is getting in touch with God, really. And this, of course, much the consternation of the priest and the imam and the pundit. What led you to want to explore this idea of unity and disunity in religion?
Well, I wanted to write a novel on faith, and I didn't want to look at one single faith, because I was afraid if I did that, the character and therefore I would be dismissed as some sort of fundamentalist. In Canada, certainly, a character who would say, "Jesus says," and then quotes Jesus repeatedly, would rapidly lose the interest of most readers. In Canada, and perhaps the same in the United States, I've noticed that people who go to church don't read novels, and people who read novels don't go to church. So I figured if I wanted to have a novel that appealed to your average secular reader, I couldn't have him practice one single religion. And so I thought, well, what I'll do, because after all, I was interested in writing about faith, not so much about organized religion. I said, well, I haven't practiced many religions, which is not really something that I just pulled out of the hat. It's interesting, in India, you actually see that. You see, especially in rural parts of India, you see people, you'll see Hindus who go to a Hindu temple, perform puja or darshan, and on their way home will stop at a Sufi shrine or at a temple of some other religion and make an offer there. In a sense, they're covering all bases. And that, in many ways, is typical of Hinduism. Hinduism at its best. I mean, recently, Hinduism is starting to be poisoned by politicization and a certain an intolerance. But at its best, the Hindu attitude is sort of welcome to the pantheon. There are legends of Jesus not dying on the cross, but coming down from the cross and moving to Kashmir and dying in Kashmir. Now, even on a mythological level, that's extraordinarily open-minded. You never hear myths of Vishnu going to Palestine to have tea. There's a certain exclusivity to Christianity that you just don't see in Hinduism. So it's not totally impossible. And the point there, as I said, is I want to look at faith. And I figured if I had him practice many religions, I would, to a certain extent, relativize organized religion and get to what's at the core of all three. Mm-hmm. And one thing I noticed in doing my research, it's remarkable to what extent the mystics of religion, and usually mystics are the ones who are the least concerned with form, who are the least ideologically driven. If you look at mystics, it's remarkable to what extent the mystics of all religions speak a same kind of language. Their relationship with God is always loving and personal, and they don't really seem to care about form. And it's when you get to more organized manifestations of religion that you start seeing the walls that we seem to think divide religions. So that's one of the things I wanted to do. And I think I have been criticized by some people who say, well, for example, how can you be a practicing Hindu and a Muslim? I mean, Islam is strongly monotheistic, and people believe that Hinduism is polytheistic. And I sort of tell them, well, Hinduism is not actually really it has the appearance of polytheism, but ultimately for Hindus, reality is one. It's just that reality is complex and has many manifestations. So I do think these religions are very different, but at their core, they reach to the same sort of groundwater of being. It's just that they manifest themselves in a different way. In much the same way, I think, that cultures are different the world over. There are different ways of being human. There are different ways of eating and dressing. Similarly, there are different ways of understanding ultimate reality. And so I think the fact that there are different religions is for pretty well the same reason there are different ways of dressing and eating. They reach to try to understand. All of them reach to understand what cannot be fully understood by humanity. And that is where you start seeing the differences in practice, is in that attempt to understand something that ultimately is beyond our comprehension.
Yeah. In the book, it begins with a writer who is in India, who went there intending to write a novel, didn't pan out, was rather unhappy, and then he meets with someone who says to him, I have a story for you. I have a story that will make you believe in God. Mm. And that man then tells the writer the story of Pi. And then the writer goes and actually meets Pi, who is living in Canada. You were, in fact, in India and had this idea that you were going to write a different sort of novel, and it didn't pan out, and you were pretty unhappy when you started thinking about and then started moving in the direction of Life of Pi. So I guess in a sense that you've already answered this question, but there is a connection between India, being in India, and this book happening. Would it have, if you had been somewhere else, if you had been in France, do you think that you would have written Life of Pi?
I'm not sure. When I started work on this book, I was clearly looking for a story to write, just because I'm allegedly a writer, and a writer has to be writing something. Mm-hmm. But also, I guess I was looking for something bigger too. And one of the reasons I decided to write this book was I was looking for mechanisms for dealing with evil. I should explain to listeners that my background is completely secular, mm-hmm. as is that of most, certainly most Quebecers. So I grew up I started working on this novel in 1997. Until 1997, religion was a completely alien phenomenon to me, one that I took great pleasure in hating. I think religion is one of the things that secular people just love detesting. We love picking on the Pope and fundamentalism and stuff like that, because it's really easy to pick at. So I was very much on the outside. And I think you're right. If I hadn't been in India, this would have been a very different novel, or it wouldn't have. I wouldn't have written it at all. And the reason India struck me in the way it did was because all religions there thrive. It is an extraordinarily fertile place for religion. And what struck me there was its imaginative content. There's a certain dourness to religious manifestation in the West. In India, it's extraordinarily colorful and loud and really in your face. And in the most extraordinary ways. I mean, some people have pointed out what a curious story I've written about, you know, theology and zoology. It's a very curious link. Mm-hmm. Well, I say, well, just go to India, actually. It's actually quite banal in India. You know, every cow you see is a manifestation of the divine. In fact, it's interesting, in Hinduism, it's a religion that's crowded with gods and crowded with animals, and sometimes you nearly feel, well, where are the humans? They're nearly on the periphery. You know, you have Krishna, who is a cowherd, who, you know, keeps cows, and occasionally he plays with humans. You know, they're sort of somewhat peripheral. So that's the idea that gave me the link. Immediately, this story of a religious boy in a lifeboat with an animal struck me as a novel about on religious matters. Mm-hmm. So no, you're right. It really would have been a very different novel had I been somewhere like Switzerland, let's say.
Yeah. The book basically has three sections three parts. And the first part is the story of Pi and his growing up, mm-hmm. and his interest in religion. The main part of the book is Pi on the boat with the tiger. Then there is a kind of an afterword. Mm. Pi survives. And he's in the hospital, he's recuperating, and this happened to have been a Japanese freighter. So a couple of guys from the company that owned the boat show up to talk with him and ask him about what happened. And he tells the story that you tell in the book. He tells the story of, well, there was a wreck, and I got in the boat, and there were these other animals, and there I was, floating in the boat across the Atlantic Ocean with a tiger. Mm-hmm. And eventually it got here, and tiger jumped off and ran off into the jungle, and some people came and helped me, and here I am in the hospital. And these two Japanese men, for obvious reasons, find the story a little difficult to believe. So Pi tells them another story, mm-hmm. which folks will have to read the book. I don't want to spoil anything. He tells them another story, mm-hmm. and then sort of says to them, "Okay, which story do you like better?" Mm-hmm. And for a variety of reasons, I think they decide they like the story of the tiger. And he and the tiger in the lifeboat better. But I think, again, what this points to is something else, and that is it's about truth, I guess, or you know, what sort of, how do you decide something is true or not, or what does it mean when you say that something is true and something is, or something is just a story?
Well, first of all, what I wanted to do in this novel is, as I said, when I wrote this novel, I was searching for ways of dealing with evil. I mean, I was 36 years old. 35, and evil was wearing me down. I was looking for mechanisms to deal with evil. Now, traditionally, one of the mechanisms for artists, anyways, is art. You know, something horrible happens, you turn it into a work of art. And it's true, art is cathartic. But I was looking for something else, and so I just thought I'd have a look at religion, because religion has a take on evil. And so I did my research. I read the great books of various religions. I read secondary texts to help me understand. And one thing that I realize, and this reflects my background as a secular person who believes in art, I decided that a lot of religious manifestation is unacceptable to me, because I think a lot of religion tries to justify itself in reasonable terms. And I thought, well, what if religion is a grand act of the imagination? What if stories have a theology? In other words, what if stories can not only just entertain us, but also give us a sense of who we are, where we are, and where we are going? And so that's what I was trying to explore in this novel, is the idea of religion as a grand form of storytelling. Now, when I say that, people sort of jump at me and say, so are you saying religion is just a story? And I was saying, wait a second, why do you say just a story? So I started looking at the idea of truth and fiction, which is nothing new, but the point I wanted to make in this novel is that truth, which is important, of course, we cannot live lives based in falsehoods. But my argument is that truth is not simply factual truth. And because we live in the West, technology is triumphant, we tend to associate truth with factual truth and nothing more than that. And we get extremely suspicious of any imaginative leap that a person might make. I mean, think of it. I think nowadays imagination is confined to sort of two areas, the world of childhood and the world of entertainment. But in our general lives, we live lives that I think are despairingly reasonable. And so I was trying to defend the imagination here. I'm trying to argue that truth, I mean, we have to start with facts. You cannot deny the facts. You can't deny gravity. You can't deny, you know, some facts are incontrovertible. But we don't stop there. I think we build our lives on a ground of truth, the way hospitals and schools and universities are built on the ground. The factual truth is just the beginning. And we interpret truth through our subjectivity. And in that interpretation, imagination comes into play. So there's one scene in the novel, this will encapsulate what I mean to say here. There's one scene in the novel where Pi goes to the zoo with his science teacher, who's a hardcore communist atheist. And at the same time, his Muslim teacher comes up. So and they're both looking at a zebra. Now the Muslim teacher, he's a baker, has never seen a zebra in his life. So he's filled with wonder and he says, Allahu Akbar, God is great, look at this beautiful creature. And the science teacher says, Equus Porcelli Bohemi, which is the Latin name for a grand zebra. So they're both looking at the same reality, but coming to a different interpretation. So the facts are there, it's a zebra. Both interpret it differently. And I think religion properly should be rooted in the imagination. And once it's rooted there, then of course you use your reason to sort of say, well, what do I believe? What does my faith mean? But that's why in this story there are two stories. What I'm saying is, here's the facts. Ship sinks, boy suffers, family dies, only human survivor to reach the coast of Mexico. He offers two stories. One is more fantastical. One has a greater claim on the imagination. One is more flatly factual. And at the end, Pi asks the investigator, he doesn't ask which is the true story, he says which is the better story. Hmm. Which helps the time go by better? Which gives you a greater sense of who you are and what you are here for? Because at the end of the day, and that's another reason why I wrote this book, is my experience as a volunteer in a palliative care center, a care for people who are dying, is, you know, when you're, let's say, 77 years old, and you're in your bed melting away of cancer, at one point I don't see the point of being reasonable. I don't see the point of not entertaining divine figures, Santa Claus, anything you want, actually, Elvis Presley if you want. At one point, what is the point of staying to the factually empirical and reasonable? You can't be deluded, you can't deny, if you're in front of a bus and it's bearing down on you, you can't sort of say, oh, that bus doesn't exist. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying, whatever happens to you, you have a latitude of interpretation. And that latitude, however thin, lies possibilities of redemption.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jan Martell. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll be giving a reading from his fiction, talking about his writing, and in particular, his second novel, most recent novel, Life of Pi, which won the Man Booker Prize for 2002. It's out now in paperback. It's published by Harcourt. Is in the bookstore if you want to look at it. Questions are certainly welcome. I also want to mention that he will be doing this reading, and anyone who is interested in meeting him and hearing him should stop by the Smith Memorial Hall Auditorium tonight, 7:30. This is an event in the MillerCom series. They're always free and open to the public. We have a couple people to talk with us here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Urbana, line number one. Right here.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I have some observations and then a crucial question. Mm-hmm. It was a great read. It was just a pleasure to read. I think his family was enlightened and had a sense of humor, took things as they were. I think he also brought in atheism as almost a fourth. I think you brought in atheism almost as a fourth religion.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, and it was I found it magic realism. It had a sense of the surreal and the exciting. But you know, I've been telling friends that you can miss the whole middle part of the book and still enjoy it, which may sound strange. While the core is religion and the experience he has when they meet those three religious leaders and his family says, let's go get ice cream, you know, he's their way of handling it. He never, when he's in the boat with three animals, as I remember, wasn't there a chimpanzee or something?
No, there's a hyena, an orangutan, a zebra, and the tiger, so there's
right,
four in all.
Right, marvelous. That part has a sense of the marvelous. But you know, in the end, it's a story of survival. Not once that I can remember does he call out to God, does he offer praise, does religion enter into it, and I think that's really a crucial question. Am I wrong about that?
No, I mean, there are a few references. He mentions trying to pray to Mecca, not wearing where Mecca is, trying to have masses with no communion host. That was very deliberate on my part. I mean, some people said, you know, how can this is a novel religion, but he doesn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. To me, you don't get to a proof of God you can't get to it by talking. You can't get to it by reasoning. Religion is something existential. And in this novel, maybe that was a slight mistake that I made, is that the part in the middle, in the Pacific, where he survives with the tiger, is in a sense so charismatic that people forget. I often notice people are looking for the proof of God, so to speak, in the Pacific, in somehow Pi triumphing over adversity or in the beauty of nature. That's not it. I'm just laying out two stories. One fantastical one, more magical, but still rooted in realism, and one flatter one. So ultimately, you're absolutely right in a sense that the part in the Pacific is just one story competing with another. Now, that one story happens to take 200 pages and the other one takes 4 or 5. But you're quite right in arguing that there's the religious, there's no religious element per se in that, there's no meditations on religion while he's in the Pacific. Because after all, people who have faith, just have it. They don't necessarily put their knuckles to their forehead and start meditating on God or having dialogues with God. They just do. They just go get by and do what they have to do to survive. So I wanted to avoid the sort of French kind of novel where there's all these long soliloquies on the meaning of divinity and all that. That's not what I wanted. I wanted philosophy through action. In a sense, one model I was using for this was Homer. Things like the Odyssey and the Iliad, where the philosophy comes through the action, and not through long discursive passages describing, you know, the meaning of God and stuff like that.
Right, and that time when they go on the island, it almost has some of the sense of the Iliad with the magical, you know, the kind of land of the lotus eaters kind of thing. But I did not look for religion. I didn't want religion. But on musing over the book, I just felt that the middle section was a could have been somebody who in a war parachutes down and survives in the jungle or something like that. It's a story of survival. He uses his wits. He finds his supplies in the boat. He keeps away from the tiger, but the tiger was brought up by hand by humans. So it really, even though it's a dangerous animal, it became another book totally. And I really do feel that while it was interesting and really well written, It became these two books that ultimately left me asking about it.
Oh, that's interesting. See, one thing I did in that first story is I wanted to make it progressively harder to believe. So most readers will accept that the boy is in the lifeboat with the tiger. By dint of realistic details, people suspend their disbelief. Then there's that encounter, if you remember, with the Frenchman.
He was hallucinating, wasn't
he? Yeah, you figure he's hallucinating.
Yeah.
And then by the time you get down, you figure for sure he's hallucinating. Well, see, I expected that. I was figuring people will be pulled along, will suspend their disbelief, but at one point it'll be too much. And then rationality will kick in. They'll start making excuses for Pi. They'll start saying, well, Pi is hallucinating because he's dying of thirst or of hunger. I wanted to play with that. I wanted a story that required at one point a leap of faith. Which is why that the island is the epitome of that. It requires most readers, I think, the rationality will kick in. They say, well, this I can't believe.
Yeah,
others would. So I want, exactly, but I wanted that to compete with a story that was flatter and had no fantastical elements, so that when he's asked at the end, which is the better story, I hoped readers, just like the Japanese investigators, would choose the story with animals. But I wanted that story to have an element of the fantastical, just as every religion, every act of faith, in fact, beyond religion, every act of faith in someone, in loving someone, demands going beyond the reasonable. And so the island represented that something that it goes beyond the reasonable.
Yeah, it's like giving yourself to a surrealist painting. I mean, you just, in the end, say, this is wonderful, because the color, the details of your book, your cataloging of events, all make it a wonderful read.
Yeah.
But in the end, while you can think about these things philosophically, it becomes less meaningful. I just think it's a terrific book. But as I said, this middle section sounds as if it's modeled on these stories of survival, and it has color that really you couldn't get elsewhere. And I think your writing is terrific. I just don't feel that you can center on religion as the core of the book. That's what I think about
it. That's fine. I think life is a story of survival, so...
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm glad you're here, and we'll have this discussion. Thanks.
Well, thank you. Sorry. So I think my reaction to the elements, the fantastic elements, was I supposed to suspend disbelief. I guess my, as a reader, I'm approaching it as, you're telling me this story, and while you're telling me this story, I guess I'm just going to go with it. I'm going to go with whatever you're telling me, and maybe later on I can decide, well, you know, how I want to feel about it. But at no point did it become too much for me, so I said, of course this is not going to happen. I just went with it.
Good. One thing I found that's quite funny with this book is the way to which it reflects the reader. I mean, a book obviously reflects the author. I mean, in some ways, a book is an intellectual autobiography of its writers. But I've been struck at the different kinds of interpretations that people have given me about my book. Mm-hmm. How they interpret the tiger, who the tiger is, what the whole story means. I mean, this lady that we just spoke with, you know, didn't find the middle part as gripping. Others, people, is the contrary. They find the whole bunch of stuff like sort of this mumbo jumbo that's sort of tacked onto the story. They don't like it at all. Mm-hmm. And they really like the Pacific stuff. And and there are myriad interpretations in between.
Well, we have some other folks to talk with. Let's do that. Mm-hmm. The next person is in Belgium, which is actually over, not far away from here, not the country.
Okay,
Belgium,
I was going to say, wow.
It's New Danville,
NPR listener.
Belgium, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. Nice talk about Belgium. Anyway, the question I have, and not to sound way too gullible or foolish about this, I've read a good portion of the book, but not all of it. And in the beginning, it sounds like you're talking about yourself in some ways, because you do talk about one book that's not so well received, and then you talk. Mm-hmm. You want to write your second one. It's some Indian tea estate, if I remember right. And go on to Pondicherry, is that how you say that?
Pondicherry, yes.
Pondicherry. Well, when in writing the book, you give credit to these Japanese sources and various things.
Mm-hmm.
And now, earlier in this conversation, you were speaking of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this the truth? Is this story real?
That's the most common question I get is this a true story? The second most common question I get is, what does the island mean? In this novel, as I said, I want to play, and it's not that I want to play with facts against fiction, but I want to say, listen, we don't just live lives, you know, based on facts, on factuality. We blend facts with our interpretation. So I want to start that right off with the author's note. Now, if you want to know, the author's note is mostly true. I mean, I was in India. The novel in question was my first novel, Self, which didn't fare particularly well in Canada or anywhere. I was in India working on a novel set in Portugal, which I'm still working on, in fact. That'll be not my next novel, the one after that.
Set in 1938, right?
Well, that's going to be irrelevant. It'll be still Portugal.
Yeah.
It's gone through many mutations. I did meet a Mr. Adidu Basami. Now, he didn't have that line, this is a story that will make you believe in God, but he had that wonderful open-mindedness to the divine, to ultimate reality that Hindus at their best have, as I said earlier. So all that was true, and there was something about his way of being that struck me, that sort of generosity of spirit that struck me. And after that, my imagination sort of took over, and I spent 6 months doing research in India. So you ask me, is the story true? Well, my answer will be the stock answer that I give to that question, which is that all good art is true. All novels are true. All paintings are true. You know, Beethoven's symphony is true. And when people ask me that question, I throw it back at them, saying, isn't that a funny question? If I did play you, if we played you on NPR now, a little sonnet by Vivaldi, isn't it a funny question to say, is it true? If I showed you a painting, is it true? It's sort of an odd question sometimes. I mean, if I said, you know, are dinosaurs still alive? You could say, well, no, and that's a simple question to which there's a simple factual answer. But otherwise, some subject matters to ask, is it true, sort of misses the boat. And I think with art, that's definitely the case. You're asking me, in fact, is it factually true? And I think that comes from an attitude in the West that the only truth is a factual truth. And therefore, if I tell you, oh, of course not, there's no pipe to tell, and there's never been a case of someone ending on a lifeboat with a wild animal, I sense that people will be slightly disappointed. Or if I said, oh, no, there is a case of a Korean sailor who ended up in a lifeboat with a wild animal, and I sort of took that and embellished it and set it in India, people would somehow feel better, that the novel was better for being rooted in a factual truth. And I think that is the result of a suspicion of the imagination. If I told you it was a complete fabrication, you'd feel, oh, it's a little bit fraudulent somehow. And if I told you, no, it's based on factual truth, you'd say, oh, okay, good, then somehow the novel's better. So I'll just reply, I think all good art is true.
Okay, I'm not sure that completely answered the question I asked.
Good, good.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Very good. Let's continue. We'll go to another caller here in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. The first thing I want to say is it makes me very sad that you're mostly exposed to Christians who don't read novels. Mostly because I was recommended your novel by someone after church one day.
Wonderful. Listen, I was just saying my experience in Quebec, which is a fiercely secular society where the Catholic Church has the stuffing absolutely kicked out of it in the early 60s. So I'm glad that I'm being proven wrong here.
Well, and even more so, I feel like there was a point where I had to decide if I was going to believe in God, and came across a children's book by C.S. Lewis,
mm-hmm.
where the children are in this deep, dark dungeon, and a witch is saying, "What is this other place you call Narnia? I don't think it exists." And they say, "Well, even if it doesn't, we're going to believe anyway because it's better than this."
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I really felt like after finishing your book, this was the grown-up way of responding to that same question. I felt like as an adult, I could choose to just believe in the better story because it made life better.
Yeah, and I've had people say, well, you're just advocating sort of solipsism, subjectivity, that, you know, whatever I choose to believe is the truth. I'm saying, no, you just have to have faith in your subjectivity. And the faith is that ultimately your subjectivity will match objectivity. That nothing religious can be proved in the here and now. Reason has nothing to say about matters of the imaginary, matters that go beyond sense data. And I'm just saying, trust your faith that it will match sense data, but only when you're dead. Sorry, that sounds so intellectual and convoluted what I just say. But I just think that faith in whatever,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's in loving a person, loving a political system, loving some interpretation of the divine, we're better to have that faith and live our lives with that faith than to have no faith at all. I mean, in this novel, in fact, the ones whom I excoriate are not atheists. As an earlier caller pointed out, to me, atheists also make a leap of faith. They argue there is nothing and take responsibility for that. They often replace a religious ideology with a secular one. The ones that I am most dissatisfied with are agnostics, who sort of are always sitting on the fence saying, well, there's not enough evidence for this or for that, so I'll just sit on the fence. And that's doable, but I think that's a way of unraveling one's life. It's a way of unliving the magic of life by always doubting. Doubt is useful. Even with people who have faith, you know, doubt keeps your faith alive. It keeps you questioning it. It keeps it alive. But if you make a philosophy of it, if you only live that, then you don't construct anything in life.
Well, and the thing that I think is so interesting is when people get to the end of the book, whether they choose which, it doesn't matter which story they choose to be true, they all have that impulse to wish that the story with the tiger was true.
Yeah. Very much so.
And it's interesting to me that some people will feel so disappointed that they can't believe that story, but still choose the factually accurate one.
Yeah, no, and that's doable. I mean, there are people who live, their entire political systems, you know, Marxism, Leninism, Communism, that is based on a scientific materialist view of life. That's perfectly doable. I just can't see the worth of that at the end of a life. I don't see what triumph there is when one is dying to sort of say, well, I've led a reasonable life. If anything, I think people who are dying, and I use that as the point when we really ask ourselves that question, but at any point in life, I don't see the point of not living to a certain extent a crazy, colorful life rather than, you know, a flat little factual life. There's, you know, we're only here for a few minutes. and there's little to be understood. And so there's never enough evidence for anything. You just have to make these leaps of faith. And you have to have faith, and then your reason of I don't also advocate not using reason. You use your reason to sharpen your faith. There's a wonderful sentence by an old Archbishop of Canterbury, Saint Anselm, who said, "Credo ut intellingam," I believe so that I might understand. It's once you have faith in something that you can put your reason to proper use. With your reason, you can then sharpen your faith, make it clear. And so, in doing my research for Pi, I read people like Hans Küng, who in fact was just criticizing the Pope recently, and he wrote these massive tomes on what it means to be a Christian, and you'd find the same kinds of things in other religions too. These people who are incredibly intelligent people, who take their faith seriously and say, okay, so Jesus is, or they'd say, Allah, whatever, Buddha, and then they use their faith to say, well, what does that mean? When Christ says, love each other the way I've loved you, what does that mean? And they try to understand it, and these are marvelous feats of reasonableness at the service of a faith. And to me, that is the way we come to a full, rich life, is something to strive for.
Well, I agree, and I thank you very much for giving me something else to remind me of that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, thank you. Let us continue. Have another caller. This is also Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I read and loved the book, and after I finished it, I was a little confused about the two endings, about the ending. And I spoke to an English professor that I'm very friendly with, and I said to him, which ending is true, and what was the author's intention here? And I could tell immediately from his reaction that it was a naive question. And I didn't listen to this program from the very beginning, but I'd love your response to that.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a naive question. It's a valid question. In fact, that the whole novel comes to that point of which story do you believe? So it's a key question. But I don't want to answer it for you. I mean, I wrote the book, but I'm not its only reader. I would argue that it's up to you to decide which one is true. As I said, you have to decide which is the better story. If you're sort of interested in what I would suggest, if you have the time, is you finished reading the book, reread part one and then reread part three, which are the two shortest parts. Reread those, and that might help you come to a decision. But I certainly don't want to give you an answer. I mean, you have a choice, obviously.
Can I impose another question?
Yes, sure.
When you wrote it,
mm-hmm.
Did you have an idea of that that the second one was true and you were just disrupting the first?
No, I constructed the novel in such a way that both stories could be plausible. In fact, I've noticed there are roughly two kinds of readers here. They're the kinds of readers who read the story, love the first story, and then when they get to the second story, they hate the second story and they choose not to believe it at all, and so they go with the first story, the story with animals. Then I have the second kind of reader who read the story, get to the second and say, I get it. So in fact, what happened is Pi's, the ship sank, Pi's on the lifeboat with various human characters, and then once that little brief, brutal story is over, he invents that first story, first of all, presumably to pass the time, and secondly, to make acceptable what is unacceptable, in fact, in other words, the brutality that takes place in the second story. So to me, one reaction is that of a believer, of someone who will take the leap of faith and believe the first story with animals. And the second one is that of the agnostic, who is ready to doubt everything and will make no leap of faith and only believe what is hardcore and reasonable. Those are the kinds of two approaches. One of the person who can make a leap of faith and one who can't. So if you're hesitating, I'd say, well, you're the one who has to, all the more reason to let you decide.
Well, let me ask one other question. I don't want to pose so.
No, go ahead.
Did you write the book wanting to pose this question to the reader?
Yeah, when I started this book, I knew exactly. I'm the type of reader who does a lot of research, prepares everything. So when I start writing the book, I know exactly what's going to happen. So I knew exactly it'd have 100 chapters, how they'd be divided. I knew exactly how chapter 100 would finish.
You wanted to pose the question for the reader.
Exactly. Yes, totally.
So you wanted my question, like...
Yes, no, exactly. That's why I said it's not at all a naive question. In fact, it goes to the heart of the novel.
My English professor didn't say that, but I felt it after his response. But I thank you very much for your very thoughtful and wonderful comments and wonderful book.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
See, now, now my position on this, now I suppose some people say, well, you're weaseling out on the question. But I guess if someone, you know, said to me, well, which story do you think is true? I would say both. They're both true.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I have to. I have to make a choice.
Hmm. That's interesting. Except, Well, that's fine. That's your interpretation. I never want to put anyone in a box. I think in life, I mean, there's some questions that don't matter. You know, did Atlantis exist? Is Elvis alive? You know, frankly, there's some questions that really you can not answer them and lead a good life. I think there's some questions though that are essential. There's some big questions that must be answered because they make a crucial difference. So either you believe there is something out there, and therefore you sort of investigate it in some way, whether you fall into a very personal kind of spirituality or an organized one, or whether you become a Buddhist, whatever, that's one direction, or you believe, no, there is nothing. We are the result, and I don't want to be prejudiced that when I say this, but, you know, we are the result of sort of chemistry and chance. And there is no ultimate final meaning, and we must construct one. And therefore, we have secular ideologies like environmentalism or communism or whatever. We construct meaning now, and there's sort of a fleeting tragedy to life, and we must take stock of that. I mean, atheism is a very brave. Nothing but respect for atheism. It's a very brave position. But I think there is a fork in the road, and you must take it one way or the other. You don't want to stay at the fork and not take a decision. And I think religion, God, is one of those. It does have such implications for one's life that we must. And often people don't. I mean, I remember in the UK, I had a few at a zoo. Oddly enough, I did some readings in a zoo, and a man wanted to defend agnosticism. And I think people are trapped in that rational. I mean, because we are suspicious of the imaginary. It's very hard to argue to discuss religion because it's been plagued by fundamentalism. You only hear the fundamentalists, the sort of people like Gandhi. You don't really hear much about them nowadays. It's very hard to discuss religion in that kind of a way. It does seem better to just be in doubt about it. But I, in some ways, and here I'll stick my neck out, I think sometimes agnosticism is a kind of intellectual slothfulness. It's not wanting to bother to make the work. And it's not daring to say yes or no, because yes implies some kind of work, and no is kind of, very final, to say no to all that kind of otherness, that any sort of reality underpinning this one. To say no to that is, and so I think sometimes, I noticed this in my university days, I'd waver between being the agnostic or the atheist, depending on the fierceness of my mood. Mm-hmm. But I think, so as I said, some questions, to get the full flavor of life, you must answer them. So, are both stories true? Maybe for a while, maybe you're still weighing them in your mind, but at one point it'd be better to go with one. I mean, after all, it's one lifeboat, one boy, something happened. And it's one thing or the other. So I think you have to, at one point, sort of come to some sort of decision, might I humbly suggest.
All right. Well, I wish we could continue to talk, but unfortunately, we have used the time that we have. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Jan Martell, he'll be doing a reading of his fiction. That's tonight at 7:30 in the auditorium of Smith Memorial Hall on the U of I campus. That's on South Matthews. This is an event in the MillerCom series, and it is open to anyone who would like to attend. They're always free, so you should definitely stop by. And, of course, if you just like to read Life of Pi, it is now available on paperback. It's published by Harcourt, Life of Pi by Jan Martell, winner of the Man Booker Prize 2002. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
We appreciate it.